Good afternoon. My name is Joseph Huff. I represent George Rainey. My bar number is 34384, and I'm a public defender. As this court might know, I raised two issues in the brief. One is sufficiency, and the other is the purported raised gesta evidence that was introduced against Mr. Rainey. So I'll start with the first issue, which is sufficiency. I think it's very important that we all get on the same page as to what Mr. Rainey actually did and what he did not do. As you will recall, the two witnesses in the case said that he either had his hand in his pocket with a bulge, or he didn't have his hand in his pocket at all, but near his pocket.
Well, don't we have to resolve that in favor of the more favorable view to the prosecution? So he had his hand in his pocket?
You can absolutely do that, Judge, and I will, even assuming that he had his hand in his pocket, that is simply not sufficient enough for aggravated robbery. And the reason is because everybody knows what the legislature here had in mind. They had in mind a person who represents, hey, I've got a gun right here, I've got a knife right here, something to that effect, or the classic case where someone puts their hand in their pocket and makes it like a gun. In this case, we have no testimony whatsoever that Mr. Rainey even referenced the supposed bulge in his pocket, much less made any threatening gestures in relation to it, or any verbal statements or representations that it was a weapon. It was simply a bulge in his pocket. And even taking the worst witness for the defense, saying he had his hand in his pocket and it was a bulge, that is simply not enough to be sufficient and substantial, which is the test for sufficiency.
Mr. Hopp, go ahead.
What about the fact that he also says, if you give me the money, nobody's going to get hurt, or something like that? I mean, he refers to hurting people.
If he had said, and no one will get shot, I won't shoot anybody, no one will get stabbed, I wouldn't even be arguing this. But he didn't, and that's why I'm drawing a comparison with this case in People v. Gregg, where this court found that the evidence was sufficient, but that's because Mr. Gregg actually represented that he was armed, that he would actually shoot somebody. If Mr. Rainey in this case, without even referencing the bulge, had said, I'm going to shoot you unless you give me the money, as opposed to hurt, then I wouldn't even argue this issue. But the point is, he made absolutely no representation whatsoever that he was armed and dangerous.
Mr. Huff, can a person's fist be a deadly weapon under the statute?
I suppose it could, but I don't believe that anyone argued that the prosecution represented that his fist had been a deadly weapon, could have constituted a deadly weapon. And I think in order for it to constitute a deadly weapon, a jury has to make a finding that it could be used in a manner to cause serious bodily injury or death. I don't think that was an issue here. If you read the opening arguments, the opening statements and closing arguments, and the prosecutor's theory was that he was armed with some sort of weapon, not his fist, or that he had represented that he had some sort of weapon on him, but the evidence simply wasn't sufficient, substantial and sufficient enough to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, even giving all the facts to the prosecution that is due.
But what about the surveillance video? It's my understanding that it showed him very peculiarly with his hand in his pocket the entire time, never removing it from his pocket, at the same time saying, nobody's going to get hurt if I get the money. Doesn't that suggest there might be a weapon in his pocket?
It's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And the point is that he would have had to have taken an extra step. And what he would have had to have done is moved it in a way, none of the witnesses testified that he moved it in any way, drew attention to it, no witnesses testified that he drew any attention to the bulge. One witness said he didn't even have his hand in his pocket, but assuming
he never took it out of his pocket the entire time, doesn't that call attention to his pocket?
It would have called attention to it, but it's not, it's just speculation. It's just conjecture that there is a weapon there. But that's not the standard here. We have to not rely on guessing and speculation. We have to reach a near certitude of guilt in order to find someone guilty under the sufficiency standard. even giving the prosecution all the benefit of the doubt, there simply wasn't enough evidence in this case to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he had an article that he used or fashioned to be a deadly weapon. And all it would have taken would have him saying, look, I'm armed, or I'll shoot you, or look at this. None of that happened. If any of that had happened, if even one of those things had happened, I wouldn't even be arguing this case. But the fact is, it didn't happen, and that's where this case departs from Gregg. And I encourage the court, which was also my case. Much worse facts, though. Much, much worse. Honestly. Go back to Gregg and read what this court said about establishing sufficiency in that case. They said you don't even have to show a weapon. You just have to say something to the effect of, I'll shoot you, or if he'd even said, I'll stab you, someone's going to get stabbed. And I would say, yes, you could infer that maybe there's a knife there. But without any of those factors at play, the prosecution simply didn't meet its burden of proof on that. If there are no other questions, I'll move on to my second issue. Now, as this court will recall, the second issue was admitted as purported res geste. And my argument is it's neither res geste nor relevant for any other purpose. And even if there is some sort of marginal relevance, it's clearly outweighed by the prejudicial effect, considering that the fact that the prosecution called 6 out of 9 witnesses to talk about this other robbery, that the court here found they didn't even prove by preponderance of the evidence that the defendant committed. Now, the Attorney General argues in her brief, well, this was fair to rebut some defense argument that maybe they didn't do investigation and maybe they needed someone, they needed a suspect. That's not what this was admitted for.
Well, wasn't it admitted to show the logic path of the investigation and how the defendant's photo ended up in the array?
That's precisely the reason.
Okay, well, why didn't defendant open that door by characterizing the investigation in his opening statement as, sort of a rush to judgment? They got to find a fall guy.
Because that's going to be the defense in any case where you have an identification issue. And what we say in opening is not evidence. And even if it were evidence, even if we had opened the door somehow, this is so remarkably prejudicial, particularly the way that the prosecution argued it up in closing, and particularly because there was no limiting instruction like we asked for, and particularly because 6 out of 9 witnesses talked about this other robbery that had absolutely nothing to do with the charged one. It was overly prejudicial. So even if there is some relevance, even if we can say the jury would have speculated as to how his photo ended up in the lineup, fine. They could have solved that or resolved that in many different ways. They could have just said, our investigation led us to suspect Mr. Ramey. Further investigation that we did concerning another robbery led us to Mr. Ramey. They didn't have to put on 6 witnesses,
Mr. Hunt,
to talk about this. Yes, sir.
Sorry to interrupt.
No problem.
My question is, you mentioned identity. Is there overwhelming evidence of robbery?
In this particular case,
yeah.
The case that was charged, I would say absolutely not. And the reason I would say that is the descriptions that the victims gave, both of them, they both said this was not a tall man. He was 6 foot or under. Mr. Ramey is 6'4". That's not something that's easily mistaken. 6'4" people don't often walk around without being noticed. And in this case, if you're the subject of a robbery, you're not going to say he could have been 5'9" when the guy that they actually described, that the guy that was actually apprehended for this is 6'4". Plus the pot marking. As you might recall, both witnesses described that the man that robbed them had severe pot marking on his face. Mr. Ramey had none. And I remind this court that both of those identifications were made well over a month after the actual robbery occurred. So there's not sufficient, there is sufficient evidence, but there's not overwhelming evidence that this was Mr. Ramey. So any sort of propensity evidence, which is exactly what this was, would have tipped the scales against Mr. Ramey in an otherwise very defensible case.
But Mr. Huff, why was it propensity if no one established that the robber in the earlier or the later robbery, the Denver robbery, was Mr. Ramey? No one, did anyone even suggest it was him?
Absolutely. The prosecutor said it repeatedly in closing.
So is the closing argument supposed to be relevant to whether the evidence was admissible in the first place?
The closing argument showcases the harm as to why the evidence was harmful and requires reversal here.
So it only goes to harm, not whether there was error in the first place.
I agree with that. It goes to how harmful and prejudicial this evidence was against Mr. Ramey. Even the trial court said there is a strong inference that Mr. Ramey committed this Denver robbery. And when the prosecution put 6 of 9 witnesses on to testify about this other thing that's only supposed to be admitted to show why his photograph ended up on the photo lineup, that's overly prejudicial.
Overly prejudicial it's a reasonable probability standard, right?
Given the fact that the evidence was not overwhelming in the Aurora case, for the reasons I just described, this would absolutely, in my mind, have changed the outcome of the trial. He could very well have been acquitted based on the eyewitness testimony that said he was 5'9" when he's 6'4", based upon the eyewitness testimony that said he had pock marks when he had none, based upon eyewitness testimony where they said we were both distracted, based upon eyewitness testimony that was given over a month later to identify him. He could have easily been acquitted if it weren't for this other robbery that they said, that the prosecutor argued in closing, shows and proves that he committed both, and the Denver one actually proves that he committed the Aurora one, and that's precisely what the prosecutor said in closing. If there are no other questions, I'd like to save my time for rebuttal. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, Catherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. I'd just like to make one brief point in response with regard to the sufficiency claim. It seems like the defense is relying primarily and heavily on the fact that the defendant did not specifically say, I'm going to shoot you, I'm going to stab you, instead simply said, I'm going to harm you. I'd like to note that statutory language specifically talks about representing verbally or otherwise that he is then there so armed. And so what we have here is we have gestures, we have the hand in the pocket repeatedly, we have the bulge in the pocket that was described as bigger than just a hand. We have the demanding tone of the defendant telling the woman with the child to go towards the bathroom, which suggests that there is danger about to happen. And we have threatening to hurt them. There's nothing in the case law, there's certainly nothing in the statutory language that suggests that you have to specify the type of harm you're going to cause. I think the evidence here is more than sufficient to sustain the conviction for aggravated robbery.
I understood Mr. Huff's argument about the failure to mention stabbing or shooting to go to whether he had a deadly weapon and versus having nothing in his pocket but his hand. So that's why it was important to say, I'm going to shoot you or stab you, because that would suggest he has a gun or a knife, and that's important for the statutory element that was alleged here.
Well, the statutory element that was alleged is that he either possesses an article used or fashioned in a manner to allow a reasonable person to believe it's a deadly weapon, or represents, or verbally or otherwise, that he is armed.
And so armed, right? Armed with a deadly weapon.
So armed. And there, I mean, I don't think there's any requirement that he specify the type of deadly weapon that he has.
Do you agree with, sorry to interrupt, you finish your statement.
That's okay.
Okay, do you agree with Mr. Huff that the prosecutor never suggested that the fist was a deadly weapon? Instead, the prosecutor was suggesting there was either a gun or a knife or some other sort of object in his pocket.
I agree with that.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
If the defendant is 6'4", and he's encountering two women presumably of much lesser stature, why does he say, you know, give me the money, nobody's going to get hurt, go beyond implying that he's going to wrestle the money away from the clerk forcibly and perhaps beat her up in the process?
Because he's not holding his hands out in a manner that suggests that he's going to harm them by use of his hands. He's holding his hand in a manner that suggests he has a weapon in his pocket. And both of the witnesses, that was their impression. That's what they perceived was going on.
That's a related question. Is the witness's subjective perception relevant?
Yes. Under Gregg, they specifically noted that the witnesses perceived him to be in possession of a weapon.
Is it what a reasonable person would perceive?
Well, in Gregg, they specifically, because we're looking at the sufficiency of the evidence in this case, it's certainly not required under the statute that the person perceive fear or harm like that. But in Gregg, when they're talking about the sufficiency of the evidence under this specific subsection of the statute, it was relevant that the victims themselves perceived that he was in possession of a weapon. They believed, even though they never saw one.
Okay, thank you.
Did you have a question? No. Okay. Unless there's any further questions, I'd like to make a few comments about the res jesse evidence in this case. One of the things I think it's important to remember is this is an abuse of discretion standard. This is relevant res jesse theory of res jesse. Clearly, the prosecution was arguing that the evidence was relevant to explain why the officers put the defendant's photo in the lineup. And I think it's important to also note the timing of that request was before trial, when there was significant litigation about whether the defense could have access to other robberies that were committed in the same area. I think there was clearly a defense investigation going on to suggest there were alternate suspects. And so if you take that, in addition to the fact that during opening statements, they did specifically say they just needed a suspect. They needed it, they got his picture, they put it in there.
Sorry to interrupt. Is it your position that's res jesse, or are you going on a relevance?
Well, res jesse is a type of relevant evidence.
Okay, so tie that up for me. How is this res jesse evidence?
Well, I think if you look at all the cases that I cited that were res jesse, they describe how it's important to describe what led to the investigation to the defendant, what caused them to have contact with him, in this case, what caused them to put the picture in the photo array, which led to the identification. And so without that evidence, and I think in Harlan they specifically talk about this as an important factor, without that evidence, the jury would be left to speculate as to why did they put his picture in. And I think that's perfectly, that's important in this case, particularly in light of the fact that they did suggest that they had to pick someone, they picked him, and then they, during cross-examination and during arguments, they pretty much accused the police officer of manipulating the photo lineup so that people could identify this particular person. And so I think in the cases that I cited, it talks about it's relevant to kind of buttress the credibility that's been challenged on that issue. And so here, I mean, there's ample cases that talk about how this type of evidence is admissible. As res jesse say, it's often admissible in hearsay to demonstrate it's not hearsay, but it's the same theory. It explains why the officers did what they did.
Well, if one of the criticisms of the officer is that he manipulates the photo array, you know, everybody's wearing a hat except the defendant, what's the probative value of the fact that they had some reason to believe the defendant committed a similar robbery? How would that make it more excusable to manipulate the photo array? I'm not seeing the nexus.
Well, I think it's the general attack to the fact that they took this investigation, they did not have a suspect at first, they got this information, and if you leave out the information about the other robbery, you're going to be left with, they got this investigation, they had no suspect, they randomly chose this person, put him in a lineup, without any explanation as to why the victim...
No, but that part that I understand, but then you went on and started to argue about, to point out that the officer had been criticized for manipulating the photos, and I don't see how the prior robbery would excuse that or explain it if it happened.
Because it shows that they had a reason to include this person in there, and that they weren't just simply picking on him and trying to create a situation where they wanted this guy to get picked by the witnesses.
Okay, thank you, I understand.
But I think again, going back to the abuse of discretion, it's important to look at all of the cases that do say this evidence is admissible. Certainly none of the cases have, or this case is not any more egregious in terms of prejudicial value than any of the other cases that I cited. No details about the robbery were included. The jury was specifically told he was not identified as the robber in the subsequent robbery. And so it would be hard to fault the trial court under an abuse of discretion standard from saying, I'm not going to apply this case law that's very similar, and instead I'm going to find that this is inadmissible.
So I think, Ms. Hansen, what about the notion that multiple witnesses testified to this? Is that true of the other cases you rely on? That seems to be a big point that Mr. Huff was making, was that even if there was some marginal relevance, it was presented in a very inflammatory, prolonged fashion.
Well, I think what you really only have four witnesses that are specifically testifying, or two witnesses that testify about the robbery itself. You had the neighbor and the clerk, and their testimony was very brief. It was very limited. It was just describing the fact that a robbery occurred and the person ran out and they saw the driver's license. And then you had the sister who testified about the one whose car it was, and through her testimony, there was a lot of evidence back and forth about whether or not the defendant had access to her car. And so while I think there was certainly probably some unnecessary testimony there, certainly it wasn't incriminating. And then what you had left was the Denver detective, who just simply explained that he responded to this robbery and it led him to the defendant's name, and he provided that information to the Aurora detective. So I think he's including those two detectives in the six, which are legitimate witnesses for this case, and then the two sisters' testimony, which is just really not that particularly important and certainly not particularly prejudicial.
But you have at least five witnesses talking about an event other than the charged robbery. You got the clerk in the other store, the bystander, two sisters, and the Denver officer, right?
Correct.
All of them know absolutely nothing about the charge of offense.
Well, the officer does, because he was the one who contacted the Aurora officer to provide that information, saw the link and provided that information. So
none of those witnesses had any direct personal knowledge of the charge of offense, correct?
No. But I would like to point out, their testimony was very brief, and it was clearly limited. They didn't give extensive details, and I think although Robinson very clearly says that we do not consider the closing arguments when considering whether the evidence is relevant, I just don't see how the comments made by the prosecutor during closing argument suggested that because the defendant committed the Denver robbery, he also committed Aurora.
Was there a Google Street Map exhibit used in this case?
I don't believe so, but there was definitely testimony about how the
Denver robbery, where it was located.
The Aurora robbery was 4 miles from the defendant's home. And that was the fact that the prosecutor was referring to in the closing argument. They were referring to the fact, just the generic facts of how it led to the defendant's photo. And the only argument they really made was that, and it turns out this is 4 miles away from the defendant's address, is 4 miles away from the charged robbery. In fact, when the prosecutor during rebuttal talked about motive and opportunity, it was clearly only a reference to the workers' comp paperwork and that link to motive, and then opportunity being the 4 miles away. And so I don't think that the arguments can be read. First of all, they shouldn't be considered. And then second of all, because there was no objection, but they can't be read to suggest that because he did one, he did the other. They specifically told the jury he was never identified in one.
But Ms. Hansen, I think you're agreeing that the evidence about the Denver robbery was admitted for a limited purpose, this sort of res justae purpose. And so if that's the case, It bothers me that the trial court refused to give a limiting instruction. I know 404B requires them, but that's, but 404B aside, Rule 105 also allows for limiting instruction when evidence is admitted for a limited purpose. And the defendant asked for limiting instruction, and you agreed that evidence was admitted only for a limited purpose. Why was it an abuse of discretion not to give a limiting instruction?
Because the case law is quite clear that for res gestae evidence, no limiting instruction is required. And again, it'd be hard to fault the trial court. In fact, that was the specific reason given by the trial court as to why he wasn't giving a limited purpose instruction, was because it was res gestae. And so again, it'd be hard to fault the court for not doing something that the case law overwhelmingly says you don't need to do.
Well, speaking of, you rely on Robinson a lot, and it's Robinson that points out the failure of the defendant in that case to ask for a limiting instruction, and it was not res gestae. It would suggest the defendant should have asked for one and did not. That's what Robinson said. And here, the defendant did ask for one.
Robinson was a hearsay case.
Right, exactly. And it didn't limit itself to 404B evidence. It said when any evidence that comes in for a limited purpose, it's appropriate or at least possible to give a limiting instruction under 105. And in fact, Robinson faulted the defendant for not asking for one, and here he did ask for one. So I'm just wondering how that factors into the analysis.
Well, it factors into the analysis because there's a body of case law saying that for res gestae, you don't give a limiting instruction. There's not a body of case law saying when you're admitting non-hearsay for a limited purpose, and if there's a danger it might be used for a hearsay purpose, you need to give a limiting instruction, or you don't need to give a limiting instruction. So in Robinson, and I agree in this case, the court could have given one. But it didn't. And so the question is that an abuse of discretion? And I think if you look at the body of case law, that's very clear with res gestae as opposed to hearsay, which is what was in Robinson. I think the court did not abuse its discretion in choosing not to.
Okay, thank you.
And this is court, has any further questions? Which I'd be happy to answer when you ask that you affirm. Thank you.
I'd like to start off my rebuttal by correcting some of the things that Ms. Hansen said, and I'm going to start with the sufficiency. The two victims in the robbery never said that they believed he had a gun. Ms. Thompson said she thought he might have had a gun, and when we probed her on that, she said, because I figure all robberies involve weapons. She never said that she thought, based on particular facts, that whoever robbed them had a gun or a knife. The other woman, from what I recall, didn't say anything about whether she thought he had a gun or a knife. So it's improper to suggest that both of these victims subjectively believed that the defendant was armed when one of them said she thought he might be. The other one, from what I recall, didn't say anything about it. And when we asked the one that thought that he might be, she said, because all robberies involve weapons, right? She didn't link it to this particular case. So I just want to be very clear about that. Both of the People v. Stark is very clear on sufficiency. It says verdicts can't be based on guessing, speculation, or conjecture. And that's precisely what happened here. You would have to speculate or guess. There's not enough evidence in the record to prove beyond a reasonable doubt as far as aggravated robbery. So I'll leave it at that. Moving on to the res gestae issue. Our primary defense was that they had the wrong guy, that he was mis-ID'd by the two victims in the grocery store. We didn't spend a lot of time saying, hey, they just randomly harassed Mr. Rainey. In fact, there's very little of that in the record if you go back through it. There might have been a suggestion that police needed a suspect, but that's very common in any ID case.
Well, I mean, that may or may not be, but don't you take the risk of opening the door if you choose to say that? I mean, you're casting an aspersion on the quality of the investigation. Why doesn't that open the door to the prosecutor saying, okay, here's why they put the guy's picture in the lineup?
Because the prosecutor could have easily remedied all of this by just saying, officer, how did you get his photo in the lineup? We had verifiable information to lead us to Mr. Rainey, or we had strong suspicion that led us to Mr. Rainey, or we received other information that led us to Mr. Rainey. They didn't have to go on and on with six witnesses, and they certainly didn't have to argue in closing that it's not a coincidence, it's just another fact that proves the defendant's guilt. And that's precisely how they linked the Denver Roberts read to the Aurora one and argued that he was guilty of both. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. That exhausts our docket, and if available, announce a recess, please.